Thanks. So, someone asked me what I was talking on at this conference, and I said I really only talk about one thing. It's just variations on a theme, right? I'm kind of like a dog with a bone. I can't let this one go, right? So I'm going to talk about ethics, individualism, and the medicalization of public health. I have no relationships to disclose. So I'm actually trained as a lawyer, a historian, and a bioethicist. I actually do all three of those different things. So like my colleague Jason, I'm really interested in thinking historically. Everything I do, I think historically, even when I'm not actually doing history, right? So I want to sort of go back to the 19th century like Jason does and think about this sort of emphasis on social reform, right? I think most people are aware colloquially that mid-19th century public health reformers in both Europe and the United States, they emphasize sort of social conditions and they emphasize social reform. Now, I have a big but there, right? And that but is actually pretty important because I think one of the colloquial views, one of the views people often have of 19th century public health reformers is that they were social justice warriors. That is not true, generally. There were some exceptions. There were some 19th century public health reformers who were social justice warriors. And what I mean by a social justice warrior is principally someone who really wants to upend class structure, which is oftentimes what we think about with social justice. There were actually quite a few of our most famous public health reformers who really were interested in preserving class structure. They're actually quite conservative little C. So for example, Chadwick, Edwin Chadwick, and some of the sanitarians, it's been pretty well documented at this point that Chadwick was hoping through sanitary reform and public health reform actually to preserve class structure, to sort of push off some of the revolutions that were going on in the 1840s and things like that. So, and there were other examples in the United States as well. Florence Nightingale, who was certainly interested in cleaning up filth. I think like most people know, probably one of the last things Florence Nightingale probably would have wanted was overturning of class structure. She was all about order, and that meant class order as well as social order. So you have to put the big but there, right? Social reform, definitely, right? Collective action, definitely in the 19th century. As an idea to overturning class structure, not so much, okay? With, again, some notable exceptions, and that idea becomes important. I'll come back to it. So, like Leonard has talked about, a lot of public health in the 19th century, certainly there were physicians, they were always involved in public health, but there were also a lot of other different kinds of people. There were lawyers, there were architects, there were engineers, there were lay people. So just giving you an example, the United States Sanitary Commission that formed during the Civil War, which is credited with doing sort of a lot to spearhead, organize, and centralize public health practice in the U.S., a lot of people don't know that that was actually headed by Frederick Law Olmsted, the architect of Central Park, right? So, because he was pretty good at managing complex projects is how people sort of thought about it, right? So a lot of different kinds of people, a lot of different social people were involved in this, right? So then something happens, right? I'm skipping over a really interesting story here. So what happens, right? Well, a lot of things happen. And I think one of my favorite papers in this is a paper by Amy Fairchild, who I think I saw in the audience, actually, Dr. Fairchild, and colleagues called The Exodus of Public Health. And so if you really want a really sort of rigorous, good look at the story of what happens between the beginning and what comes later, that is really the place to look. There's a lot of things that happen. Medicine becomes professionalized. The bacteriological revolution happens. There's this emphasis on little bugs. I'm actually trained as an historian of ideas. So one of the things I'm interested in is the idea of truth and objectivity sort of becomes invested in objects inside the body. This is where you get the growth of pathological anatomy and bacteriology. The bacteriological revolution happens sort of right in concert with this. So this really becomes this emphasis on individual bodies and pathological processes within individual bodies, and that begins to, among other kinds of things, have a pretty pronounced effect in what public health practice is taken to consist of. So there's the citation, Dr. Fairchild. So a lot of this I call, and I'm not the only one who calls it this, but I like this phrase, I call it methodological individualism, right? The idea is that the individual, the social phenomena in which we are interested in becomes explicable in context of the individual agent. That's really what I'm talking about. And this idea of methodological individualism actually comes from the philosopher John Elster, is where I take this from. So a good example of this is the idea of prevention. Dr. Ortman talked about this, right? I mean, prevention is something we do in public health. But the late, great Barbara Starfield warned us that the idea of prevention, of social prevention, of what some people call primordial prevention, right, has almost been captured. It's been taken over by this idea of preventive medicine. Preventive medicine and primordial prevention are not the same thing. And I'm not actually saying that preventive medicine isn't a good thing or that I'm not a big fan of it, because I am. But there are different evidence bases, right, that support the cost and the safety and the efficacy of certain kinds of preventive medical interventions, right, which again are targeted at individuals, and collective action on structural determinants of health. That's primordial prevention, that's social prevention, and that is something different, actually. And so this is an idea of how public health, I think, becomes medicalized, about how it really begins to be sort of captured by this idea of the individual. Now, you might say, well, individualism didn't just sort of become invented in American history at the turn of the 20th century, and you'd be right about that. But I think what I'm really talking about here is a shift in emphasis. And that would really, that's what I'm really sort of focused on, this sort of emphasis away from collective social action to this focus on individual bodies, right? So I am an ethicist, and one of the things that I get sort of, I'll be perfectly honest with you, I think Jason, unlike Jason, I think I wanted to get up here and rant a little bit about the things that really grind my gears, to be honest with you, right? So one of the things that really grinds my gears, to be honest with you, is we have all of this great evidence, and I rely on it because I'm not a public health scientist, but all this great epidemiologic evidence that document all of these social inequalities. And what happens then in terms of policy and ethics is we typically move just so to conclusions, right? We think, oh, well, we ought to fix them. Right, well, there are some problems there because, first of all, not all inequalities are unjust. I'm willing to say that probably most of them are. But the classic example I give is that there was a stark inequality in basketball talent between LeBron James and myself. Right, I mean, this is not something we're morally concerned about, right? So not all inequalities are unjust, and even among those that are, we still have to figure out which are our priorities. Most of my work in public health ethics is about priority setting, right? So I think we need some models that help us think through what should we be doing. And one of the ones I'm attracted to, and there are others, is Madison Powers and Ruth Faden's health sufficiency model of social justice. So Powers and Faden have an answer to the question of which inequalities matter most. They say it's those inequalities that fuel these densely woven patterns of disadvantage, right? And this refers to the sort of epidemiologic fact of compound disadvantage. We know that if you're a member of a group that experiences one social disadvantage, you're also likely to experience other social disadvantages as members of that group. This is a group-level phenomenon. It's not going to be true of everybody in that group, but it will be true of most members of that group, right? And so these are the ones that it becomes almost impossible to break out of. This is what Powers and Faden say. And so these are the inequalities that we have to target the most, right? So just to give you an example of how I think medicalized and individualized public health interventions sort of miss the boat more often than not is by looking at what's called the twin aims. And this is something that Powers and Faden endorse, and I talk about this in some of my work as well, which is, I think, the best kind of ethically optimal public health policy ought to have two goals. The first is improvements in overall population health, and the second is compression of inequities. Now, that doesn't sound like anything particularly exciting or controversial until you start to understand that actually a large percentage of our favored public health interventions do not maximize these two goals. Okay? A very large number, and I'm going to give you a good example in a minute, a very large number of them actually will only maximize one but not the other. Okay? And unfortunately, I think many of them, and there are some exceptions, for example, vaccinations, which I don't know whether we call those medical or public health. I think they're probably both, right? Those are targeted at individuals. Those are, I think, wildly successful, and I'm a big fan of vaccinations, so don't throw anything at me, okay? Those are exceptions, but a lot of other of what I call medicalized and individualized public health interventions, they often fail both prongs. So they exemplify methodological individualism. So I'll give you two examples. I'll give you an example. And the classic example I use is smoking cessation programs. And I'm not opposed to smoking cessation programs, I should say, but they are a dominant response. One of the dominant public health responses, a categorical public health response to tobacco consumption. And the problem with, there are two problems with smoking cessation or these other kind of medicalized public health interventions. The first is that they generally don't work very well. They generally don't work very well, right? So generally a good rate of success for a smoking cessation program is what, 5%? 5% is pretty good. Anything more than 5% is really, really good, right? So generally, I mean, I'm not sniffing my nose at that. 5% of a large number is still a pretty good number, right? But generally, they don't work very well, right? So they don't really do much to maximize population health. That's the first prong of that test, okay? So that's the first problem. If that was the only problem, we would stop there. It's not the only problem. The problem is actually much worse than that, which is that to the extent they're effective, they actually tend to expand health inequalities. Why do they do that, right? Well, because many of these public health interventions are what has been referred to as agentic. That's what I mean by individualized. They're agentic. They depend for the capture of benefit on the resources that an individual agent can bring to bear. A lot of lifestyle change intervention guys are agentic, okay? A lot of health education and promotion interventions are agentic in nature. They depend on the individual. And the problem with that is that usually individuals who have more resources are better able to capture the benefit of those kinds of interventions. That's not always true, but it's often true. And that's exactly what's happened with smoking cessation programs, right? The affluent, it's easier for affluent people to quit than more deprived people. People in resource-poor settings have a much greater difficulty changing their behaviors, for example, than people in resource-rich settings. And so what happens is it doesn't work very well. That's one problem. To the extent it does work, inequalities between the affluent and the deprived in smoking actually increase. And that's not speculation either. That is actually exactly what's happened. Overall incidence in tobacco consumption has decreased, which is a good thing, but the inequalities in smoking-related diseases have actually increased between the deprived and the affluent in the United States. So I'm not prepared to say that we shouldn't do smoking cessation programs. That's not actually what I'm arguing. But that is not what I would call an ethically optimal public health intervention. It has a place as part of a bundle of public health policies, but as a dominant response, it's probably not a good idea. So what are some of our ethical priorities if we were to move away from some of these kind of medicalized, individualized focuses? Well, I'm sort of all about collective action on the structural determinants of health. That maximizes the twin aims, right? That's more likely, we know, to robustly improve population health and break patterns of compound disadvantage. One of my favorite examples, and this is the one I sort of talk about all the time, is intensive investment in early childhood development. The evidence on that, as far as I'm aware, and again, I'm not a methodologist, but the evidence on that is pretty much as good as it gets. I'm not even aware of much dispute about this, right, basically. Jason was referring to the idea of future publics. And one of the things we know that early childhood development can do, it can actually improve the health of the next generation, right? So if you improve the health of a child age 0 to 2, that child's progeny will actually be better off. And the predictions for that are pretty robust, right? So this is really good. This is going to improve health, absolutely. It's also going to break patterns of compound disadvantage. This is what Powers and Fiends were talking about. This is pretty good, right? This is where we should be going. This is a classic example of a priority. And there's actually a really, really wonderful film coming out about this called The Raising of America, which is a little plug, by California Newsreel Productions, who produced the award-winning documentary on natural causes, which is on the social determinants of health. So this, their next film, as a follow-up, is all about this evidence and, frankly, why we don't do it in the United States, because we really don't fund it very well, right? So another example that I'm sort of fond of is anti-stigma mechanisms, primarily through law, actually, although there's other ways of doing it as well. The evidence on this is not quite as robust, but there's increasing evidence that stigma itself, which is something I work on, is an independent social determinant of health that looks like it's actually pretty bad for you. People who are stigmatized get sicker and die quicker. And we also have pretty good evidence that there are lots of remedies which are at least somewhat effective in reducing these kinds of things. But we have to specifically target the source of the stigma. And you can do that through laws, you can do that through policies, and there are other kinds of interventions as well. But those are some of the examples that I focus on. So moving towards collective action, and notice that this is a question mark, a return to its public health roots. That's a question. I mean, in the 19th century, it was certainly characterized, I think, by more collective action on public health priorities. Why there was more collective action is a totally different question. I think it's very dangerous to assume that there was more collective action because that was a more enlightened time. And because the actors involved were sort of actively focused on upending class structure. I don't think that the historical record actually bears that out, with exceptions. Again, there were some people who were, but many of them were not. Many of them were actually quite conservative. So what roots are we returning is a good question I think we need to ask, right? A hierarchy, of course, persists. What are our goals? Is destabilizing social hierarchies a legitimate public health goal? I'm sort of involved in a long-running argument about that with some colleagues, whereas I say, well, what would we be doing if we weren't doing that, to be honest with you, given the influence of social hierarchies on population health outcomes? And the response which I get, which is not an implausible response, by the way, is no, I think the response I usually get is people say, well, that's a great idea. I think we should absolutely do that. But that's not what we do in public health, which, of course, is actually why I'm giving this talk today. That is not what we do in public health, okay, I think traditionally. And so that's really the question to ask, is this something we ought to be doing? And if so, how are we going to do it, going to Old English, Middle English, right? So how are we actually going to do it? I work with public health students all the time, and I ask them, you know, you guys are going to go off and work for LHDs. Is this what you're going to be doing? Are you going to be doing these kinds of things? Are you going to be destabilizing social hierarchies? Are you going to be throwing sand on the copying machines? Is that what's going to happen, right? Or are you going to be doing a lot of sort of health education and promotion, vaccination-type activities? And I think you all know what the answer to that question is, okay? So the last thing I want to say is that, look, even though I'm sort of obviously a rank and a raving collectivist, individual agency does matter. It really does matter, and I sort of don't want to sort of paper over that, right? And we know that when people don't feel that they have agency on an individual level, that's a huge problem with the conditions that are available for them to flourish. People don't do very well when they feel like they lack any agency over their situations. And so individual agency does matter, and we also know, and this is sort of, I think, the other important thing to note is that even people living in straitened circumstances and under structural constraints can make better and worse decisions. I mean, structural constraints are extremely important, and I have this sort of collective focus, but people can people do have some level of choice, and I think it's important to preserve some level of agency. So these are all questions. It's meant to provoke you guys and get you guys mad a little bit so we can start talking about it. Thanks.
Why don't you guys come on up here? So we're going to open it to questions and comments and maybe some argument. This is, in my opinion, a momentous challenge that our panel has put in front of us. It is very easy to answer the question, what is the ethical dimension of individualism, because it all comes down to what's in it for me. Once we decide that we're actually going to take up the challenge of thinking about community seriously, it presents to those of us who are involved in public health ethics, and I would argue that everybody in public health is involved in public health ethics, that we now have to have that discussion about what are the moral or ethical underpinnings of having a more collective public policy making. With that, I'll start calling on people, and we'll have a discussion. You were first.
I want to say, my name is Ron Bale. I'm from the University School of Public Health. I want to thank the panel for being kind of angry. But I want to make an observation and raise a question. The observation is, a number of you use the example of what's happened with tobacco, and I think what's interesting with tobacco is, in fact, we have moved to an explicitly paternalistic stance. The measures that have reduced tobacco consumption are not the individual interventions of cessation, but they are taxes, limitations on where people can smoke, and public health campaigns that frankly denormalize smoking in a way, by the way, that tends to stigmatize smokers, and by the way, it tends to work. So the question is, why have we moved in the direction of paternalism with tobacco? And I think in part it's because the only people who smoke now are poor people, or mostly, and it's much easier to be a paternalist when you're dealing with people without high school education than people who have graduated from university. The question I have for all of us is, Michael Walzer very wisely pointed out a long time ago that critics need to have a dialogue with the communities from which they emerge. And if they're not in dialogue with the community, they sound like howling wolves, howling dogs of the wound. The problem I think we confront public health and in the ethics of public health is finding a language that is not strange to Americans, that they can hear and that can shape a discussion moving forward. I think if you try to move forward with policy in the United States using the language of solidarity, you're finished. It's not a word that people in America hear. They hear solidarity, you might as well be talking about Karl Marx. So the question is both it's really a deep empirical question. RWJ now wants to kind of create this healthy communities, whatever, and they think the problem is messaging. Messaging is not the issue. The issue is finding a deep moral language that doesn't sound un-American. You said explicitly, the language which you can use on the continent is different from the language you can use here. And I think the point is we have to not howl at the moon, even though the moon may make us very angry. We have to find a discourse that works, and not a language that worked in the 19th century, but a language that worked in the 20th.
I want to move to the past, not because I at all disagree with it, just because I'm very excited to hear you say that, but I want to get the panel's reaction. What is the language that you're going to go out to the American public and say, look, we need to start thinking about community and collectivism and the like?
First of all, I just want to say I agree with totally with what Ron has said, and our opponents in other political parties and in the commercial world fully understand that fact. And we are academics in many cases, or we are scientists, and we have a very difficult time in translating what we want to say into terms that people can understand. So I fully agree with Ron that we need to find that language. I don't want to claim that I have found that language, but I do think that it is in principle possible to do that. We just simply haven't done that. And the other problem is that, you know, we howling wolves are often taking our cues from you know, the critical literature or the European tradition, and so that's what we're more familiar with. But that doesn't mean we can't learn how to translate that into an American idiom. So I'm agreeing with him, saying it's a thing to be desired. I certainly haven't done it yet, but I'm willing to work with people who want to go that way.
I agree completely, and I, you know, I've thought about this, and I think, you know, I grew up in the South, and I think about some of my relatives, and I think, like, well, how would I sell it, right? And, you know, how do I, and, you know, I keep coming back to two issues. One, I think we have an extremely robust language of fairness in the United States. I think Americans understand it. I think it resonates with Americans. I think it is part of our psyche as much as the And I actually think more attention to our history, you know, and I found this more being in California, that, you know, we can't, so take the Chinese community, right? We can't think of the Chinese community as outsiders, as external. You know, the Chinese in America built the railroad. They are as American as we are. They are as Californian as we are, right? That we expand our history and sort of see that all these communities sort of struggle together and look at these fairness issues. But that is sort of my first take.
And I'll just make a clean sweep, Dr. Baer, by saying I don't disagree with you at all either, right? I mean, I guess what I'd say is two things, right? And I should disclose. So first of all, I have a policy background. And second of all, part of my work, both my practical work and my sort of training, I focus a lot on the psychology of communication, right? Thinking about to whom am I speaking and what is the audience? I mean, what is the language that I can use to sort of reach this audience? So it's a question that I'm sort of occupied with all the time. And I like to joke that I got my law degree first, proving I'm a ruthless pragmatist at the end of the day, right? So I think there are two things. The first thing is I'm actually sort of attracted to RWJ's campaign on this, right? I mean, branding, I agree with you, is not a word that I'm particularly comfortable with. But it really is, you know, there's really good evidence, especially if you look at what psychologists are doing, right, cognitive scientists, about what kinds of languages can we use to reach people, sort of people outside of sort of cloistered halls of academy and think tanks, on issues related to collective action and structural determinants of health. And there is some good evidence, I think, that's increasing out there about, you know, what kind of language can be used, not just to talk, but also to listen, which I think is probably even more important, to be honest with you. So I think I'm sort of attracted to those ideas of thinking about technical communication with different kinds of audiences. And then I sort of, the second thing that jumps to mind is some of Scott Burris's work regarding polling and support for American public health practice, right? I mean, the sort of the hoary thing that we sort of cling to in public health is that nobody likes public health and nobody funds public health and everybody hates us and yada, yada, yada. And as it turns out, I mean, some of the work that Scott's looked at is, you know, suggesting that depending on how you frame the language, there's actually wide support for public health interventions, programs, and initiatives. Not all across the board, but certain ones in particular. And a lot of it has to do with the language that you use. So I think at the end of the day, I wonder if the political will is there regardless of what language we use. And I admit to that. I'm not an optimist. But I think that that's where it has to be. I mean, we have no other choice as far as I'm concerned.
My partner and I both are Soto Zen practitioners. So your question is, I laugh a little bit, but yes, you are right. I don't think what we're talking about is European. I mean, it is European, right? But I think we're talking about something that fundamentally is very American, and that we just forget, you know, sometimes.
And the first question?
Yeah. First question, does it have something to do with money? Well, everything has something to do with money, right? I mean, so yes. I mean, yes, I'd say sure that has something to do with it. But also, I mean, yes, and there are examples of that, like sort of the rush to screening, which is both a medical intervention and, I think, a public health intervention, right? I mean, I think, you know, screening can be quite lucrative depending on what kind of screening can be done. And the evidence for its impact on population health is mixed. It depends is the right answer, as far as I know, right? So that's an example of it. But I'd also suggest that we haven't really figured out a great way to monetize true public health, to be honest with you. I'm not even saying we should, by the way, either. That's not it's not a normative claim, right? I'm just saying we haven't. And the fact that we haven't monetized it, I'm sure, has something to do with the terribly unequal distribution of health expenditures in this country. I mean, you guys know the ratio. It's like 96 cents out of every dollar we spend in this country goes to acute health care expenses and biomedical research, right? So some of that flow is, of course, directed by capital and the pursuit of capital.
Yeah, I would sort of emphasize that point. And you will often talk to doctors, you know, say, I know someone I talked to in a NICU, and there's this issue to, you know, take an example of, you know, with preemies. You're never going to get an individual parent to say, okay, for the sake of the whole system, I'm just going to let my baby die, or I'm going to let my grandmother die, and I don't want this big tech thing that you might create to save. So at that level of the individual, you know, this is, I think, what Sarah Palin struck a nerve. It's such a, you know, a death panel. Someone's going to say that, you know, your grandmother can't have, health, you know, we can't save her. But what we have to do is not feed the monster, so to speak. We have to stop putting our dollars into creating ever more sophisticated technological machinery that's very expensive on the one hand. You get less and less bang for your dollar. You know, you'll extend the life of someone 86, 3 months of low quality life. And at a social level, what we have to do is say, we have to invest that, you know, $10 billion now in health, you know, in early development of children. So we preclude the discussion by putting our health dollars there so that we don't have to make this individual decision of whether we're going to keep a preemie, you know, keep pushing that envelope to keep the preemie alive. So that's, I think, in line with what we're saying here, that, you know, the social collective decisions have to be made at a different level so that we don't have to make these. I mean, you can't tell someone, you know, choose society at large instead of your grandmother, your mother, or your child. That's, I think, that's too hard.
I'm going to ask you a quick question. Raise your hand if you have kids. Wow, almost 60% of you. So I do this presentation called The Cost-Benefit Analysis of Having Children. It turns out to be a terrible investment strategy. And I'd be happy to send you the slides for it. But my point is that there's a danger, just like buying into the language of individualism defeats the ability to talk about public health in a robust way. Buying into the notion of monetization defeats our ability to talk about why we're doing public health, because whatever we're doing in public health has more to do with why we have kids and why we spend all of that time and money raising them than it does, you know, where I put my pension funds. Here.
Okay, so my question sort of is about that last point on your slide about individual agency mattering. I myself embrace this collectivist idea, but I know that a lot of people in our country don't. So how do you blend this idea that individual agency does matter into a collectivist approach? Like, do you try to tell people that you want to help the population, but you realize that individually they're so important? Like, how do you mix those two ideas? Because I don't think you'll ever convince every
this is my slide. I guess I'll go first. I'm just smiling because welcome to the frustration of my work, right? So there's the sort of, I'm an ethicist and a pragmatist at the same time. They're not mutually exclusive, right? But so the ethicist in me is always, is in part talking about normative. What ought we do, right? Now, it's not enough just to do that. It's not enough just to say we ought to do something that we can't do, which is where I sort of come in and say, well, what are we going to do? How are we going to do that? How are we going to get from A to B? I mean, you know, I think, in part, I think it does have to do with rhetoric, and rhetoric is a dirty word for a lot of people, but I think rhetoric is actually extremely important. It's in part about knowing your audience and thinking about what language are you going to use that's going to be able to speak to that audience, right? Otherwise, there's really no point, right? And I think this is partly what I was saying in response to Dr. Baer. You know, I think there are ways, right? For example, I mean, there are issues that you might call the thin end of the wedge. There were some social determinants people who had some success in the 90s in Houston, which is where I was first, for example, by working on primarily couching what they were talking about in terms of education, and in terms of children, right? Because depending on languages that you use and how you frame particular issues, you know, supporting education, access to education, and supporting children can be something that can generate uptake from different kinds of people coming from different backgrounds of different political persuasions in the United States, right? So that I'm not going to tell you that's going to solve our problems, right? But I think it has a lot to do with how you sort of frame the language and is there a way of sort of getting some purchase there? Is there a way of getting a foothold? That's the best I can do.
If you actually think about the core idea of Adam Smith, it's a idea of how to, you know, it's the idea of the invisible hand, that by each person pursuing individual interest, it redounds to the social good. Now, I think the mistake that is made is to think that, you know, it'll just do that automatically. You really have to have it regulated to maintain it. But I don't think that was invented by capitalism. If you actually look at the first treatise in Western culture about economics, it's by Hesiod's Works and Days. He talks about the notion of the two erises, the two eris, not eros, eris, envy, and talks about how it's the envy between, you know, individuals who want to be better than, you know, show sort of like Thurston Veblen's idea of conspicuous consumption, that it's by people sort of competing, keeping up with the Joneses, that's a fundamental sort of impulse of human beings, and that the genius in political organization is to set up a social structure or system so that when they do that, it redounds to the social good. If you look at an organization like the Masons, for example, if you look how they rise up their social hierarchy to become whatever it is, the Grand Vizier or Grand Alhambra, they have to do all these socially useful and good things. They put on a benefit for mentally retarded children and so on. So I think it's possible to set up your social structure, and I think this is really the deeper wisdom that's inherent in the market system, where individual ambition is tied to the social good. And I think that can be done in a whole lot of ways. So I think that's a very ancient idea, and it's really at the core of capitalism, but it's also at the core of Western civilization. Because this was applied by the Greeks to the Olympics, the spirit of competition. It was applied to the way they did tragedies. They always had Sophocles competing against 16 other, you know, people. So it was always done as a competition. So I'm not one of these people who thinks competition is bad, but I do believe it has to be regulated. And one of the problems with our economy is the political process has been, you know, taken over by the big companies, and we don't really have anything like adequate regulation. So
you had a question earlier. I missed you.
Yeah, I did. I wanted to ask you all how you would apply the work of Restaurant Opportunity Center across the country, Rock United, and fighting for the rights and safe workplace conditions of low-wage restaurant workers. There's a number of reports in a number of cities about the effects on front-of-the-house staff, racism in hiring, sexual harassment, bad workplace conditions, and other movements along those lines, Fight for 15, as potential examples for local health departments, for the CDC, to address the structural issues that you so well bring up. I think the American public is actually doing this. And we need to support them, and we need to connect with this social movement to do a good job in addressing inequities. And to me, it seems like it gets at some of these issues. So I'm just wondering what your thoughts are.
To speak to one part of that, I mean, I think you're right to say that sometimes I think this has already happened, right? In some ways, I think my audience is like the membership and leadership of APHA, right? Like, my worry is that, yeah, I think this is happening, and perhaps APHA or we are sort of the ones who are disconnected, right, from what's happening. So, I mean, I think you might be right. Like, yeah, this is happening in some places, and you know, I think sometimes we're speaking some different language that I don't know.
You know, my view on a lot of issues, like say education. You know, we're trying to create all these sort of what I call pseudo solutions. Let's have what was the latest fashionable nonsense in education? Let's have these educational test standards.
Common Core,
whatever it is. I've come to the conclusion that I have faith in the American people and that they can right themselves if you give them a chance. Maybe this is part of the language that Ron was talking about. I really think that if you raise wages for a lot of the poorest people, they're Americans like everyone else. They would do right by the kids. They would get them ready for school. But when you have three or four jobs and trying to take your kids to day school, and work and do all that, you can't really take care of your kids. If we would just give poor people more money, a lot of the problems that arise as a result of not having enough resources would right themselves. I think the educational problems would right themselves. They'd get their kids ready for school. And I think the same is true of, a lot of the health problems. So I do believe that is really, I'm a Keynesian in that regard, and I really think that would work.
So one of the, you mentioned Garrett Hardin, one of the things that I've been thinking about lately, along with Ron, is fear, crisis, and panic. And as you think about sort of the languages that work in public health, maybe not to create a sense of a collectivity, but to create a need for collective action, certainly the language of fear is one of those languages. You might argue that the language of fear is what gives us the first public health institutions in response to cholera, in response to yellow fever. In the context of the Cold War, we do a lot of institution building in public health. We get the Academic Intelligence Service within the CDC. But this is also, if you think about fear in public health campaigns, HIV, obesity, smoking, it's also sort of a thing that's seen as being very conservative and very individualized. So what's the place, I'm not saying it's the only language, but what's the place for, what's the need to create a sense of crisis around things like global warming, around things like, think about the IOM report, sorry state, that shows that we're at the bottom of the heap. Think about all the headlines. America is dead last. So what's the place for the language of fear, the language of crisis, and maybe, again, not creating a sense of collectivity, but creating a need for collective action?
I think I'll just start. I think it's a great question. I think the thing that jumps to my mind is a lot of the fear, to my mind, that prompts some of these sort of organized public health responses is almost fear of an acute event, right? So whether it's an acute disease, right, or it's an acute need in context of the Cold War, or a recent example we saw with anthrax, right, there was a huge influx of funding in the post-9/11 phase, right, partly as a response to this fear. And I'm not actually opposed to that at all. If it can be harnessed as a tool and used for the benefit of public health action, I think it's really good. But I think part of the problem is some of the things we're talking about, especially when we start to deal with social determinants of health, and this goes to Jason's point, is they're sort of protracted, right? I mean, we won't see the impact of this for a long time. It's not like stockpiling Cipro in the case of anthrax, right, where if something happens, you can just dispense a drug and, right, and take care of it. So I guess what I'd say is I think it would be great, and I'm not at all opposed to its use personally. I don't have a huge ethical problem with it at all. I guess I just wonder the extent to which, how far upstream will that need go, help us get, right? I mean, I know there were some studies that showed that most of the funding for bioterrorism that happened after 9/11 went to security concerns, just straight up national defense security concerns with very, very limited health impact, right, actually once the assessments were done. So that would be my concern. It would be more one of efficacy, right? But as in terms of using the language, I think it's fine.
But I do think the fear and the cholera and the epidemic, I think it also... It reinforces existing inequities, right? Because
sure.
Early cholera, you blame the Irish. And in the South, the blacks for yellow fever, right? The Chinese for plague. And now we're blaming Africa, you know, we try to target Africans for Ebola. I mean, Americans, I think, were very, with these epidemics, they almost always, whoever's sort of the, you know, being ostracized is suddenly, you know, pushed upon, you know. And regardless of disease, it seems to be persistent. So, yeah, I mean, yellow fever and cholera got us health boards, but also got, like, shotgun quarantine and lynching.
I also worry about the fear is the wrong level of analysis again. It is that individualistic, and we should do something about climate change because it's going to affect you directly in the next 2 weeks. It might be... efficacious in the short run, but in the long run, the point is something other than fear. It's concern for the other. It is caring for the other. You know, a positive statement of why you should do this, not because you fear, but because you're a caring person and there are other people.
Harden does that by sort of kind of giving us an apocalyptic vision of what's going to happen if we don't put our own, if we don't sort of check our own freedoms.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You know how hard it is to stand here and not just talk? I had no idea. Really difficult. Yeah.
Yeah. I just have a problem with words like fear and panic, and because I feel that just like with 9/11, everybody was so good and so communal after that, and then after a while we get sort of used to our old ways, and that fear and panic and sense of urgency sort of dissipates, and we go back to our old ways. So I have a feeling that public health needs a more sustained kind of language, something, and I think about a book that I've read recently, Michael Sandel's What Money Can't Buy. Now, are you familiar with that? Now, anyway, you know, he talks about how market values crowd out morals. And I teach at a university, and I'd like to think that we could have conversations with this upcoming generation about who we want to be as people, as individuals, as members of the community, and get down to discussions about that. Because, can money buy, or are we a collection of organs, say, where we can sell our parts for money? Can we buy friendship? What are things that money can't buy? Who are we? In a community, you can't buy friendship because you can't buy caring. You caring is a part of a communal kind of a value. And I don't see us as having these kinds of conversations, which should be preludes to anything else we talk about public health.
There are a couple of other people. I want to just let them have a chance to talk, even if we don't get a chance to respond. Yeah.
Okay, so two quick things. I work in public health research, communications, and public health organizing. Those are really everything. Some are going to go away quickly, so I would really hope that this is an additional session. From a journalist perspective, I think this idea of changing the conversation, one of the really changing from a more reactionary perspective to more radical, and not in terms of like the more radical fierce people, but the root causes. So from a journalist perspective, I would be taking advantage of opportunities to connect the dots between current events and the broader systemic effects and causes of these events. For example, like at the open discussion yesterday, I thought the keynote speaker did a good job of saying, you may not think that I
I love the idea of making this a general session as far as diversity. Jump on a board. It's a big bus, and I think the more voices, the better. You know, there's a lot of stuff like that. A lot of, you know, psychologists and neurophysiologists are starting to look into this. And so more and more literature is kind of coming out. I went to a, 3 months ago, I went to a session where they talked just about this issue about the power of fear. And we're saying it actually works better than positive messages. But then the guy said some of the latest research is suggesting, Ron, something, not solidarity, but the language of compassion and shared, you know, you don't have to say that word solidarity, because then we think of Lech Walesa, you know, but somehow then the language of compassion and doing something together as a community can also be very powerful. So what I gathered from that was this idea of putting shock with the fear stuff, turning to community, and so a lot of people are doing this. A lot of people are studying, you know, what is the language of Republicans? Is it Lakatos who's talking about, you know, don't think an elephant? That there's a lot of stuff being done on how to persuade people. And it all goes back, I'm a philosopher, Aristotle, can persuade through emotion, through values, and through logic. Most of the people we deal with aren't scientists. Emotion works, and as long as you link the emotion and the values to the underlying truths, you're okay. It's when you then use emotion and discourse about values to do an underlying lying about things that you're a sophist. And I think the people we are dealing with, in many cases, are sophists, but we can use the language of emotion, and we can learn from all these behavioral psychologists who are looking at this, and learn how to translate our scientific discourse, as Ron was suggesting, into a language that resonates with the emotions of the people that we want to persuade. And that's not being a sophist, that's just using the power of rhetoric.
So I'm afraid we're out of time. I do want to, because I'm standing here, I'm going to talk. the one word that we have not talked about, and I would directly respond to Ron, is spirituality. That's what the American public understands, and that public health is not talking enough about. Okay, thank you.